Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economic. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money. And hold that money. And practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marches, they never changed anything.
Bye.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This, God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had number shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him, and then you felt like you wasn't worthy, and so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room, and I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me, and I said, I want you to do this graph for me, and that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on not meant to be way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it's on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin.
Welcome back. We are debating whether big-time college athletes should actually get paid. In the crossfire are USA Today sports columnist Christine Brennan and NBA Hall of Famer and legend Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. And we've been really trying to figure out, you know, get our heads wrapped around this thing, because what you're proposing, it sounds like common sense, but it's actually pretty radical in that you would have people showing up at college, they've got their book bag, they've got their linen, and rather than just being a regular student, these people would be getting paid, and I guess they'd be getting paid maybe more than their professors, getting paid as much as a college president. I mean, how is this going to actually work, and aren't you concerned that if we create this superstar class of these like multimillionaire students wandering around, I mean, what does that do to all the rest of the kids who just want to play for the love of the game?
The people that want to play for the love of the game can do that. There are intramural leagues that they can play in. The people that want to play competitively against other schools, I think they deserve to get some remuneration from what they create for the school. The school makes a lot of money. You got coaches in this country that are making like several million dollars a year, and they're not supposed to be amateurs, but the people who are actually going out there and going to practice every day, they're supposed to be amateurs. The hypocrisy is too blatant and obvious to ignore, man. Something has to be done about it.
Well, Christine, let me build on what Kareem just said. Sure. We have a map, which I think may have come actually from your newspaper, which is the coaches as highest paid state employees. You look at this map. Yeah, I think it's like 37 or 39 states, you have a coach as the highest paid state employee.
Yeah.
Now, isn't it a little bit silly to suggest that an industry with this size TV contract, with this size salaries for the coaches, somehow is, quote, an amateur industry?
Right, yeah. Well, as long as it stays in the college model, I guess we have to consider it that. Again, if the universities want to keep this as a college endeavor, they've got to play by the rules of the law, and the law says you're paying all of your athletes, the Olympic sports, the non-revenue sports as well. But without a doubt, things are out of whack. When I started my career, I covered the Miami Hurricanes for the Miami Herald back in the 80s. President there, Tad Foote at the time, talked about making Miami an Ivy League institution. It's a private school. It's an excellent school. And at that exact same time, the U, the Miami football program, was taking hold, and I covered the first national title. Within a couple years, Jimmy Johnson shows up, Dennis Erickson, and the rest is history. If you followed college sports, you know that became a renegade program. So here was an example of a university president who said all the right things, and the football program took off. So the presidents, frankly, in my mind, are the people who have let this happen. They could have policed it. They could have corralled it. They haven't. And they are as culpable as anybody in this conversation.
But isn't that true? I mean, it's not just blatant things. Isn't it true across the whole system that the pressure to win, the pressure to be good enough to be in that nice TV contract, leads people to fudge at the margins all the time?
Absolutely. We're seeing it from Penn State to USC. I cannot remember this many incidents of recruiting violations or other things that have been going on.
So wouldn't we be better off just to be honest and have it up in the open and say, look, this is the nature of the system?
Well, as I said, yes, but honesty is good. I think all four of us would agree. We're for honesty. But what we're talking about, we're looking at this through the prism of sports, which, of course, here we are. But we're looking at men's basketball and football. If you think of a university, UCLA, incredible sports all the way around, from gymnastics, what have you. My alma mater, Northwestern. Women's lacrosse has won 7 of the last NCAA titles. Gives Northwestern an incredibly wonderful, proud feeling for our women's lacrosse team that I didn't even know existed 10 years ago. The point being, you can't just take football and men's basketball out of the equation as long as you're going to work with the laws of the United States of America.
Well, fine. That's all good, well and good. But first of all, you're in some ways making my point. You have this big pile of cash that corrupts grown people. Let's give it to the kids. I mean, I don't know that this makes sense to me. I'm thinking about my own kid. I've got a son named Cabral. He's 9 years old. He is a great soccer player. And you know why he plays? For the love of the game. Do you think he would be a better player if at the end of every game he got more cookies and more snacks than the other kids because he was a great player? What happened to the love of the game?
The love of the game can continue, but what needs to be dealt with is the fact that all this money is, the whole college system is awash in all this money, and they purposely keep the people who are making this money from getting their hands on any of it.
But what would you be mad?
So many of them come from poor circumstances and could use it for a number of things, but they don't get to do it.
I don't understand then why you aren't just saying the kids shouldn't go to college at all. There should just be some kind of new league for young people or something that's a professional league. But if you're talking about college students, it seems to me that the point of them being there is for them to get in those books and learn. Now, obviously, there might be some tiny minority that get a chance to do what you did. Most of those young people, though, are not going to be benefiting. Where's this money even going to come from to pay these superstar athletes? You're talking about the NCAA. That's a not-for-profit, isn't it?
It's a lot of profit going on there. I told you, the president of the NCAA made $1.7 million.
Well, that seems like a lot.
That's a lot of money. And it's not, this isn't equitable.
Yeah.
And the whole idea is that the people who are generating this revenue should get some of it. I'm not saying that they should get it all, but they should get some of it and allow all of the schools to share. I think revenue sharing is also something that has to be part of all this.
I think it's important, though, to add at this point that a college scholarship is worth something.
And they get
a
lot of money.
They get
a
lot of money. My newspaper, USA Today, did come up with a story a few months ago talking about the value of a college scholarship. So you're at UCLA. You obviously got a chance, of course, to play on 3 national championship teams. You're getting incredible coaching. You're getting, of course, an education if you want it. USA Today said $120,000 a year.
Are you in the 1%?
What about those players, though, that go out there and a guy tears his knee up, and they take his scholarship away?
Well, that's wrong.
He can't continue at the school. He has to either come out of his pocket or go to a JC. All of a sudden, his career is down the tube, and he has nothing to show for it.
So something
has to be done about that.
Well, right? we might get a bit of agreement here.
Terrible bit of exploitation there, and yeah. something has to be done about
but,
that.
But one step would be to require that when you give a scholarship out, as long as they are trying, they get to keep the scholarship. I mean, you wouldn't want to give it out if somebody that dropped out didn't do anything. But so that, in other words, if you got injured, you automatically get the scholarship for all 4 years.
California has passed a law known as the Student Athlete Bill of Rights, and schools generating more than $10 million a year have to provide for all of the guys that are on scholarship so that if they get injured, an insurance policy will pay for their rehabilitation and enable them to finish school. Now, the state of California has done that, but the NCAA should be doing that.
Mm.
That should be on them to protect these people in some way so that at least they get the opportunity to have an education. But there are so many of these guys that are just going there to be seen. In many ways, the NCAA is an unpaid minor league for the NFL.
In that sense, Christine, wouldn't you agree that the NCAA probably ought to be deeply reformed, that in its current operating system, it's just wrong?
I think reform is a good thing. And I think what's happened, not to defend the NCAA, people would laugh at the thought that I'm defending them because I have been so critical in many ways, but they are working on a model new that comes from a different era. The money, there was a 1984 Supreme Court decision that basically put all these teams on TV all the time. The money is flowing like crazy, just what we need, more money, right? Because if you're paying athletes, the question is, could there even be more corruption? We've seen it anyway, but at all times. But I think your point is a good one, that the NCAA is trying to work in a system that no longer exists, and money is flowing everywhere. But I don't know that we want to, I guess my point earlier, I hate to think what it would look like if it's the Wild West.
But shouldn't you have an equity and this happened to you, when somebody's identity can go on for 30 or 40 years being exploited by other people with no compensation at all. So you have, whether it's in a game that's being sold or it's in a brochure or it's in a sweatshirt or what have you. I mean, the folks who are in the field sweating or in the stadium sweating aren't getting that money as a general rule.
I would quibble with the word exploited because, again, I think there is incredible value to that college education. As I said, 120,000 is an estimate that USA Today had from experts. And I think when you think about it, whether it's the lacrosse player, the swimmer, the football player, men's or women's basketball player, when they graduate, let's say they don't go pro, but they have gotten to know the bank president, and the bank president from that school hires them. What is that worth? And again, that stage that you had at UCLA, what was that worth to you? I mean, that's how I first heard about you and was aware of you. And yes, you went on to the NBA, but I'm sure you have teammates who had that great moment at UCLA who are still living careers to this day because of what they did at UCLA.
That's possible, but on the other side of that, you have a school. There was a football player named Dexter Manley who was able to attend Oklahoma State University. And he played there for 4 years. And we find out after his professional career is finished that he was illiterate. Now, how is somebody going to go through 4 years of a college and come out being illiterate? That is rank and obvious exploitation. He was there because of his athletic talent. That's the only reason he was there. And, if we let these things continue to happen, it's just going to get worse.
Look, this is, I hope we can come back again and continue to come. This has been a great and very enlightening conversation. I want to thank both Christine and Kareem for coming.
My pleasure.
It's been a terrific thing.
Millions of viewers began tuning into college basketball's March Madness games today. Billions of dollars are paid for the TV rights. Last year, an average of 11 million people tuned in throughout the month. And yet, one question looms larger than ever. Should the players be entitled to compensation? Our economics correspondent Paul Solomon explores the issues this would raise. It's part of his weekly Making Sense report, which airs Thursdays on the NewsHour.
In the corner, O'Bannon. Bruins with a three.
I saw myself on a video game.
Former UCLA star Ed O'Bannon, MVP of the 1995 NCAA Finals.
That's pretty cool to watch. I mean, the guy was left-handed, ball-headed, jumper was good. So I was very pleased about it.
But the friend who showed O'Bannon the game was puzzled.
What's funny about it is he says, We paid X amount of dollars for it, for the video game, and you didn't get one penny.
It was this encounter that sparked the famous firestorm. Ed O'Bannon's eventual 2009 lawsuits against the NCAA and video game maker EA Sports for blatant and unlawful use of student-athlete likenesses to increase sales and profits while denying college athletes any share of the revenues they generated, besides a full-tuition sports scholarship.
Close to 15 years later, and they're still making money off of my image. I just thought to myself, there's got to be something wrong about this. If I was an entertainer of any other sort, would I have these same things happen to me, you know?
No, you get royalties, residuals.
Absolutely.
Yeah, there you go. Smile, hold it.
We come to find what's happened to Ed O'Bannon and his suit, landing in Las Vegas, passing the Strip, more decked out than ever, winding up in Henderson, Nevada, where O'Bannon works, lives, and helps coach basketball at Liberty High School. He now coaches the NCAAers of tomorrow, who, if they're absurdly good and lucky, will play in a Final Four themselves someday. The rights paid to the NCAA to broadcast the tournament this year, nearly $1 billion. The players take, still zero. New York Times columnist Joe Nocera has long made the case for paying so-called student athletes. It's starkly laid out in his new book, Indentured.
They are fundamentally exploited by a system that makes not millions of dollars, but billions of dollars, and that enriches everybody around them except themselves.
But athletes, if they make it, make millions of dollars.
Sure. The very small 5% who make it from college to the pros will get very rich. What about the other 95%?
O'Bannon became one of the 5%, and yet in college, he often went hungry for lack of cash.
There were many nights when I went through the night without eating.
You?
Oh, absolutely.
It's simple, gentlemen. The little things is what's going to win us the game.
Back at Liberty High, the coaches were prepping the Patriots for a playoff game.
Do what got us here. Have some fun. Get us winning.
Kyle Thaxton is one of the team's stars. Should college athletes get paid?
If they're the ones playing, doing it on the court, then they should be the ones getting paid also. It shouldn't just be the coaches.
Coaches who can make $6 million a year or more. And it's not just pay.
In NCAA sports, you have players who can be stuck with sports-related medical expenses.
Ramogi Huma, who played football at UCLA, has been doing the lonely work of organizing players.
Injured players can lose their scholarships. Graduation rates hover around 50% amongst the sports who are generating this money. And the NCAA is refusing to adopt the same concussion reforms that the NFL has adopted. We're not advocating for professional salaries and things like that, but we're saying that, look, some of that value should be given in the form of basic protections like medical expenses and degree completion.
NCAA President Mark Emmert declined an interview, but we caught up with him at a press conference. Why not pay college athletes?
Because they're students and they're not employees at the end of the day. You know, young men and women come to college because they want to get an education, because they want to participate in their sport as part of that educational experience.
We relayed Emmert's response to Ed O'Bannon.
The way that they run their business, and that's what they're doing, they are running a business. You can't possibly do that and think that you're employees, because these athletes are employees, they shouldn't get paid. That is, to me, is mind-boggling.
But it was time for the tip-off. In the playoff game, the home team seemed comfortably ahead. But big-time college sports is rarely comfortable, says Joe Nocera.
Really, being an athlete on a campus is a full-time job. The NCAA rules say it's only supposed to be 20 hours a week. But if you go on a road trip, they only count the time you're on the floor. So when you're in the airplane, when you're in the hotel, that doesn't count.
And on campus,
you have weightlifting in the morning, then you go to some classes, then you've got practice. Then you've got more strength training. Then you've got enforced study hall. You know, you go to bed at midnight, you get up at 6, you do the whole thing all over. It's a full-time job. And not only that, let's be honest, there's a cartel that is suppressing the wages of the labor force, if you want to think about it in economic terms.
Cartel, we ask the NCAA's Emmert.
He's allowed his opinions.
Turns out it's not just the NCAA that has a problem paying players, though. Cardozo Law School professor Iko Yanka.
The more and more we treat them as young minor league professional athletes, the further they'll get from the other things that we find valuable about college.
Or as Liberty High senior Khalil DeRuin put it,
we don't want the importance of being a student to be diminished more.
Moreover, Iko Yanka asks, if you pay basketball, football, and baseball players,
what does that mean for our water polo team? What does that mean for volleyball? There is a dangerous line here where the very natural thing to do would be to have 3 revenue-generating sports and get rid of all the others.
So Professor Yanka has an alternative for athletes who aren't students.
If there are young people who are not at all interested in being student athletes and their life's project is to develop their particular athletic talent, there ought to be a professional developmental league into which they can go.
Right now, the main option for young basketball players remains going to an NCAA college.
Do almost all of them think they're going pro? That is, people who play in Division I college, let's say?
In my experience, yes.
And it's a delusion, right?
It's a delusion, but I think it's the right delusion. You have to think you're going to go in order to get there.
Okay, so what happened to O'Bannon's Liberty Patriots? Hoop dreams dashed, theirs, and by this time ours, they wound up losing 67-61.
As a coaching staff, we tip our hats to you guys because you played hard all season.
What you guys did today in these previous 4 years, you will get to further your education and get it paid for. That's the goal. Hey,
and maybe even getting paid extra in cash. And so, in the end, what's happened to the lawsuits? Well, EA Sports actually settled for roughly $60 million, with thousands of players past and present getting on average about $1,600 each. The money finally awarded just this week. In 2014, the court ruled the NCAA's refusal to pay players was an antitrust violation, and also ordered up to $5,000 per student-athlete be put in trust for using their likenesses. But the NCAA appealed, and the money award was reversed. And so, this Tuesday, O'Bannon's lawyers asked the Supreme Court to review the case. In Henderson, Nevada, this is economics correspondent Paul Solman for the PBS NewsHour.
Thank you.
All right, let's get into this first. About a week ago, the Gavin Newsom, the California governor, signed the Fair Pay Bill, which is going to allow college athletes, and I'm not sure exactly what the specific parameters are, but the it will allow college athletes to get endorsement pay, to profit from endorsements, and I don't know if it requires anything else. But the NCAA is saying that the law is unconstitutional. I'm not exactly sure why that would be the case, but maybe they're talking about their own constitution. The bill has been signed, and here's a moment on Fox News Live. With what's the woman's name? Sandra Smith and Bill Hammard here with Charles Payne. And Charles Payne, this is fascinating because Charles Payne is really, really emotionally invested in this issue, which is great. I'm glad he is. The funny thing is what he attributes it to is not exactly Charles Payne, who has a show on Fox Business, may not
be 100% clear on what a capitalist is.
Story, this was an interesting perspective from that coach there.
Yeah, you know, and ironically, I think he says, though, that he does support the athletes even being paid. He thinks the governor shouldn't be involved. I don't know about this staying in your lane. That's a red flag for me when anyone tells somebody else to stay in their lane. I'm not sure if he thinks the governor shouldn't be looking out for everyone who lives in his state, including the homeless, including the underprivileged, and including kids who are going to college there. So I don't know that that's outside
well,
the lane.
Well, his point
governor.
Is, why are you focusing here when we've got a serious
right.
homelessness
but I
problem?
I think he could do more than one thing, right? I think he can deal with homelessness and say, by the way, you know, these kids who are at schools where the coach is making $5 million a year from wearing, Nike shoes, maybe they should get paid. A lot of them don't even eat. You
so
know,
now we know where
properly.
You stand.
Yeah, well, I'm a capitalist. And I believe, you know, when I hear people defend the status quo that I think is unfair, whether, you know, the people who came out and said they hated President Trump's trade tariffs battles
mm-hmm.
with China, although China's ripping us off, it's not the right way to go. They hate this idea.
Pause
although,
it for 1 second. I just can't let that slide by. You can be a capitalist and want people to get paid who are working for you, but that is not – your being a capitalist does not require you to – demand fair wages. In fact, one could make the absolute argument, the absolute opposite argument, that in fact, it is the capitalist ethos that says, if we can get these folks to play for us for free and we can make money off of them, that's capitalism. That is capitalism.
It's a structural imperative.
It is. You need that dynamic. Yes, indeed.
Yeah, the capitalist storms into the room and says, I'm shocked to find that exploitation of labor is occurring in here.
Right, exactly. Now, you don't necessarily have to have slave labor to be a capitalist, but you need a delta between what you make off them and what they're making. That is capitalism. So, to say that you're a capitalist and that's why you want them to get fair pay makes absolutely no sense. You can be a capitalist. You can say, I happen to be a capitalist who wants these players to get paid at least somewhat what they're worth, not totally what they're worth, but somewhat. But you cannot say the reason why I want them to be paid is because I'm a capitalist. Now, maybe Charles Payne doesn't know exactly what a capitalist is.
Defend the status quo that I think is unfair, whether, you know, the people who came out and said they hated President Trump's trade tariffs battles
mm-hmm.
with China, although China's ripping us off, it's not the right way to go. They hate this idea, although I do think players should get paid. It reminds me of the abolitionist movement in this country. I've studied it. I continue to study it. And so many, quote unquote, good people say, yeah, I'm against slavery, but now is not the time to fight it. You know, and if we...
Well, why is a full ride not enough, Charles?
It's not enough because...
Pause it for a second. Can I also just comment on Bill Hammard? There's something very odd about his behavior, and I can't quite put my finger on it, but he has that thing. Let's just, when you've got to do this thing where it's like your expressions, just listening, are so studied that you need to freeze after you say something like that, it suggests to me something's up. I'm a little bit concerned about Mr. Hammard.
Why is a full ride not enough, Charles?
It's not enough because if I bring in $10 million and you give me $100,000 in value for it, it's unfair.
I'm 18.
It's
I'm
unfair.
Getting a full ride to
a
great American university that's given me another chance.
You can't make $5 million off of me and tell me, oh, in return, I'm going to give you a $50,000 education. It's not fair. It's just not fair. You're ripping these people off. They are being used and abused, okay? Give them something because you are making millions off of them.
Guys, so what's
this
the price
usury.
Then? What do you pay them?
Pay them something more than zero. Pay them something more than zero. You are making millions off of them. Millions. Mm-hmm. It's an unbalanced relationship. Nobody in this building would work for less than they thought they would work.
When I was 18 years old, if you came to me with a full ride for a scholarship, I'd be
dancing. Yeah, but if you could dunk the ball from the half-court line and your coach made $5 million a year because you could do that,
I'd go to the NBA and I'd make even more money than you're talking about.
The bottom line is I think people should get paid for what they're worth.
You made your...
There you go. You know, there's nothing... Like, This is where I feel like what I should do is just quit this job and spend my entire time to develop a mechanism that can tell me what those Fox hosts are thinking as they keep their mouths quiet and watch something like that. Because you know they're going like, this is getting uncomfortable. He seems really passionate about making sure these people get paid. Weird. Super weird. And Hammerd is just trying to, you know, maintain. But there it is. Good. I mean, I wish that someone like Charles Payne had the ability. Maybe he does. Maybe this is, you know, maybe this is one of those inciting events. Like Shep Smith, basically the inciting event was Katrina. He was on a bridge in Katrina. I remember this. Bill O'Reilly was saying, like, they don't appreciate what's going on there. And Shep's just like, you don't get what's happening here. You don't understand it. And I think that's basically when Shep Smith decided, like, I can't do this anymore. Maybe there'll be a moment where Payne realizes, like, maybe I'm not so much of a capitalist. Or maybe, like, there's something wrong with capitalism because it was structured under specifically a capitalistic principle. And it will be structured under a capitalistic principle when these guys get chicken feed for what they're doing. And the idea that Bell Hammerd thinks that these guys, you know, a small percentage of them will go into the NBA, and the rest of them will have bodies that have been beat up by playing college sports. Some instances, you know, debilitating injuries for the rest of their lives. They will have had their studies largely, not all college athletes, but their studies largely ignored because their job is to go and play on that team. And so it is so overdue. It's unbelievable. Like this pretending that they're anything but professional athletes.
Yeah, it's a similar thing with grad students who teach classes, right?
Grad students that teach classes, and frankly, adjuncts too, for that matter. I mean, there's a whole series of these questions, and I think, frankly, you know, for grad students and adjuncts, it's gotten worse. It's been this bad for athletes, you know, forever.
And each time they renew a TV contract, it just looks worse and worse.
It looks worse and worse.
Well, welcome to the left, Comrade Payne.
There you go. Who knows? He could be sitting right next to us.
He seems like he's got a critique of neoliberalism.
Let's throw to our economics report. Folks,
in college sports, American universities are exploiting disproportionately black athletes for billions of dollars while diminishing their education, health, and safety. Let me start with a bit of history. In November 1984, an undersized quarterback from Boston College named Doug Flutie threw a game-winning touchdown pass against the defending national champions, University of Miami. As the Hail Mary pass floated through the fall air in front of a packed stadium, millions more watched with excitement on TV. After the dramatic win, undergraduate application rates at Boston College shot up by 30%, revealing to universities the enormous marketing value of building high-profile sports programs. That same year, the United States Supreme Court heard a case in which the universities of Georgia and Oklahoma challenged rules that limited the number of football games they could play on TV. Those schools saw the opportunity to not only make money by televising their games, but to also market their universities to the world. The Supreme Court agreed that the broadcasting restrictions were illegal, and schools began to negotiate TV deals worth millions. That case opened the floodgates to money in college athletics, and with it, ever-growing conflicts of interest that prioritize sports over education, promote wins over health and safety, and reinforce the disturbing racial and economic inequities in our country. Since then, the growth in college sports has been extraordinary, and schools have earned record revenues year after year. The spending during that same time period has increased at almost the same dramatic pace as universities engage in an arms race to the top of the rankings. Massive expenditures on new stadiums, bigger staffs, and record salaries have made it appear, on the books at least, that athletic departments are losing money while they build lavish facilities and make multimillionaires out of coaches and administrators. In fact, in 40 out of 50 states, the highest paid public employee is now a college football or basketball coach. Meanwhile, college athletes, whose elite talents generate these massive revenues, are not only denied the ability to share in the riches they create, too many of them are not given the education they're promised either. Today, college athletes are exploited to the tune of almost $15 billion. That's how much money is generated by college sports each year. And I'm all too familiar with the exploitation because I used to be responsible for enforcing it. Following my own college baseball career at the University of Dayton, I went on to law school before becoming an investigator at the National Collegiate Athletic Association. I traveled to college campuses across the country and helped enforce a 400-page rulebook that denies athletes the right to get paid for their performance or even profit from their own name. For instance, unlike the music student who, in addition to their scholarship, can get paid to record a song, or the English student who, in addition to their scholarship, can get paid to write a book, college athletes cannot profit from their talents, or even take a free meal without being ruled ineligible and risking their scholarship. During my time as an investigator, I questioned hundreds of athletes and their families about their financial transactions, dug through their personal bank and phone records, and scrutinized their relationships to a humiliating degree, all for the possibility that someone gave them something beyond a scholarship, no matter how petty. In one case, I questioned Ohio State football players who received free tattoos and cash in exchange for memorabilia. The case received national attention and became known as Tattoogate, as if it were a scandal on par with political espionage. The players were suspended and had to repay the cash as well as the value of the tattoos. In effect, unpaid athletes were fined by a billion-dollar organization that gets paid by sponsors to decorate the athletes in corporate logos. I was told my job was to promote fairness, but there was nothing fair about that. Shortly thereafter, I left the NCAA and started fighting for the athletes. It became increasingly clear to me that rules supposedly designed to prevent exploitation instead allow a collection of universities and their wealthy corporate sponsors to profit off the athletes, who are promised an education and lured by a chance at the pros, but who too often end up with nothing. Now, some people believe college athletes get a free ride. However, there is nothing free about risking health and safety while working 40 to 50 hours per week as you fight to keep your scholarship. In football alone, there are over 20,000 injuries a year, including 4,000 knee injuries and 1,000 spinal injuries. Since 2000, 40 players have died. Beyond football, a recent study revealed that an estimated 60% of Division I college athletes suffer a major injury in their career, and over half of them endure chronic conditions that last well beyond their playing days. There is nothing free about that, especially as the NCAA refuses to enforce health and safety standards and has denied in court it even has that responsibility. And about that education they're promised, according to the College Sports Research Institute, black football and basketball players in the top five conferences graduate at 22 and 37% lower than the undergraduate population. Those who do graduate are often shuffled into majors with watered-down courses that conform to their athletic schedules to simply keep them eligible. The time demands and required focus on sports makes it challenging for even the most well-intentioned athlete to get a meaningful education. This is unacceptable for a $15 billion industry run by institutions whose mission is to educate young people. Although plenty of athletes succeed, Their achievements don't require rules that deny pay or a system that limits educational opportunities or neglects health and safety. The fact is, American universities oversee a multi-billion dollar entertainment industry that denies fundamental rights to its essential workers, a disproportionate number of whom are black, while making millionaires of largely white coaches and administrators. This dynamic has not only deprived many young people of a meaningful education, it has shifted generations of wealth away from mostly black families and represents the systemic inequities plaguing our society. The good news is that people are starting to see the truth. The NCAA's own public polling has revealed that a staggering 79% of the public believe that colleges put money ahead of their athletes. State and federal lawmakers, both Republican and Democrat, have also taken notice and started to act. Several U.S. senators have rightly described the problems in college sports as a civil rights issue. Meanwhile, college athletes from across the country have started to stand up to demand greater health and safety protections, representation rights, attention to racial and social justice issues, and economic fairness. Those who think the players should just stick to sports fail to recognize how rarely college athletes speak up and ignore the great personal risk they take in confronting a powerful industry, especially without any representation. More importantly, critics fail to acknowledge that college athletes are simply seeking rights that are afforded to virtually everyone else in this country and basic protections that shouldn't even be in question. I agree that college sports should be an enjoyable distraction, but not when they're distracting us from the very injustice they enable. In his retirement, the NCAA's first and longest-serving executive director, Walter Byers, described college sports as the plantation mentality, resurrected and blessed by today's campus executives. This is a telling quote from the man who designed this system and the one who knew it best. But you don't have to be an insider to recognize the exploitation of young people. You don't have to be a Republican or a Democrat to be troubled by the irresponsible spending or the disregard for values at our universities. You don't even have to be a sports fan. You just have to believe in basic ideas of fairness and the values of higher education. So let's require that all college athletes are given a chance at a meaningful education. Let's demand responsible spending by our universities and fairly allocate the billions of dollars being generated. Let's create robust health and safety standards to protect those who entertain us with their bodies and enforce those standards. Let's provide college athletes with a representative body so they have recourse when things go wrong and a voice about how to make things right. Finally, let's rise to the challenge of our time and once and for all correct the persistent racial and economic inequities that apply to college sports and beyond. Change is long overdue.
My name is Barney Greenwald.
Pleased to meet you. Have a crack up?
Yeah.
Are you our lawyer?
Well, I'm a lawyer.
This is Ensign Keith, Lieutenant Kiefer.
Keith, you're the co-defendant.
Yes, sir.
And you, Mr. Kiefer?
I'm holding his coat.
What does that mean?
I'm a friend of the family.
That's pretty flip under the circumstances, Mr. Kiefer.
Sorry. I was on board the Kane, communications officer.
I'll be frank with you two. I've read the preliminary investigation very carefully, and I think that what you've done stinks.
Well, if that's the way you feel about it, then why are you taking the case?
I didn't say I'd take it. I told legal I'd have a talk with Mr. Merrick. Whether I take it or not depends on what he has to say.
Steve, maybe you'd better get yourself another lawyer.
Try it. Eight other officers have already turned it down. I don't want to upset you too much, but at the moment you have an excellent chance of being hanged.
We'll answer anything you want to know, Mr. Greenwald.
All right, Mr. Merrick, which are you? A fool or a mutineer? There's no third possibility.
Well, I guess the only way I could prove I was right was to let the ship go down.
Three ships were lost in the typhoon, you know.
Sure. And 194 stayed afloat without the executive officer relieving the skipper.
There wasn't any other choice. Hold it, Willie. Okay, maybe I was a fool, but I'm not a mutineer.
He should get a medal for what he did. He had a paranoid skipper who went to pieces when the ship was in danger. And he saved the ship.
The Navy has three psychiatrists who are prepared to testify that Captain Queeg is completely sane.
Sure. Paranoids are clever. They walk a thin dividing line between sanity and lunacy.
Are you a psychiatrist, Mr. Kiefer?
No, I'm a writer. It's my business to be a judge of human behavior.
I see. And you were the first one to notice the captain's psychotic symptoms.
Yes.
You explained all this very carefully to Mr. Merrick, of course.
I discussed it, yes.
Well, that's an interesting point. Would you be prepared to repeat it on the witness stand?
Why not?
Mr. Kiefer, you ought to take a look at Article 186 of Navy Regulations. An officer relieving his commanding officer or recommending such action, together with all others who so counsel, must bear the legitimate responsibility for and must be prepared to justify such action.
That's confusing the issue. I'm not on trial. If I were, I'd take the rap with the others.
It's too bad we can't use you as an expert on psychiatry. After all, you made the diagnosis.
Yes. The atmosphere's getting a little thick in here. If you can get along without me, I'll wait in the hall.
Tom had nothing to do with it. It was my decision. Nobody counseled me. Nobody told me what to do.
Sure.
Will you take the case?
I'd much rather prosecute.
Well, I guess I can't blame you.
I'll take it.
How do we plead?
Your case depends on Merrick.
Well, then how do I plead?
Not guilty, of course. You're a great naval hero. Well, well, well. The officers of the Kane in happy celebration.
What are you, Barney, kind of tight?
Sure. I got a guilty conscience. I defended you, Steve, because I found the wrong man was on trial. So I torpedoed Queeg for you. I had to torpedo him. And I feel sick about it.
Okay, Barney, take it easy.
You know something? When I was studying law, and Mr. Kiefer here was writing his stories, and you, Willie, were tearing up the playing fields of dear old Princeton, who was standing guard over this fat, dumb, happy country of ours, eh? Not us. Oh, no, we knew you couldn't make any money in the service. So who did the dirty work for us? Queeg did, and a lot of other guys. Tough, sharp guys who didn't crack up like Queeg.
But no matter what, Captain Queeg endangered the ship and the lives of the men.
He didn't endanger anybody's life. You did, all of you. You're a fine bunch of officers.
You said yourself he cracked.
I'm glad you brought that up, Mr. Painter, because that's a very pretty point. You know, I left out one detail on the court-martial. Wouldn't have helped our case any. Tell me, Steve, after the Yellowstone business, Queeg came to you guys for help and you turned him down, didn't you?
Yes, we did.
You didn't approve his conduct as an officer. He wasn't worthy of your loyalty. So you turned on him. You ragged him. You made up songs about him. If you'd given Queeg the loyalty he needed, do you suppose the whole issue would have come up in the typhoon? You're an honest man, Steve. I'm asking you. Do you think it would have been necessary for you to take over?
It probably wouldn't have been necessary.
Yeah.
If that's true, then we were guilty.
Ah, you're learning, Willie. You're learning that you don't work with the captain because you like the way he parts his hair. You work with him because he's got the job or you're no good. Well, the case is over. You're all safe. It was like shooting fish in a barrel. And now we come to the man who should have stood trial. The Kane's favorite author. The Shakespeare whose testimony nearly sunk us all. Tell him, Kiefer.
No, you go ahead. You're telling it better.
You ought to read his testimony. He never even heard of Captain Queeg.
Let's forget it, Barney.
Queeg was sick. He couldn't help himself. But you, you're real healthy. Only you didn't have one-tenth the guts that he had.
Except I never fooled myself, Mr. Greenwald.
I'm going to drink a toast to you, Mr. Kiefer. From the beginning, you hated the Navy. And then you thought up this whole idea. And you managed to keep your skirts nice and starched and clean, even in the court-martial. Steve Merrick will always be remembered as a mutineer. But you, you'll publish your novel. You'll make $1 million. You'll marry a big movie star. And for the rest of your life, you'll live with your conscience. If you have any.
Now, here's to the real author of the Kane Mutiny. Here's to you, Mr. Kiefer. If you want to do anything about it, I'll be outside. I'm a lot drunker than you are, so it'll be a fair fight.
And that was a couple of clips from the classic, what would you call it, naval military legal drama, The Kane Mutiny. Those are like two of my favorite scenes out of that movie. Today, I highly recommend it, watching it if you haven't watched it, The Kane Mutiny. It had an all-star cast. Humphrey Bogart is Captain Quigg. Van Johnson, Jose Ferrer, Troy Donahue, E.G. Marshall. Had quite a few. He had a pretty star-studded lineup. In any event, today we covered earlier our podcast title, which is also a question, should college athletes be paid? We had Van Johnson that was commenting on it, along with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. And I'll play one of those clips again. But my take on it is, and I'm a former Division I athlete myself. I attended school on a basketball scholarship. And I basically didn't have any problems with the scholarship system. And then looking back on it now, several years later, I think the scholarship system versus the paycheck system, which doesn't exist with athletes, college athletes, is a better system. And here's where I'm going with this. Let's look it up. All right, let's look at Jabbar went to, when he was Lou Alcindor, he attended UCLA, so let's look up UCLA tuition. And he was from out of state, so the out of state tuition today, you know, coming from New York, will be $42,994. Okay. Now, with a athletic scholarship, since, you know, he played basketball and I played basketball. All right, let's look at it too. So the scholarship covers tuition, books, room and board. Okay, all you know, all that, it's extra. All right, so, you know, we had to look up how much the room and board is, because we're talking about, you know, you get a meal card, that's three meals a day, which I'm sure he had that. I had that as well. Then the room, you got to, you know, tuition is one thing, but, you know, you got to have a, you know, if you're going to stay on campus, that costs money. That's over and above the $42,994 tuition. Then you have medical, you know, in case you get sick or injured or whatever. I had a health card where, you know, I only had to use it once in 4 years. And it was something minor. You know, you go to the clinic there on campus, and like I said, I only went once in 4 years, but I just showed the card and I was good to go. So we have to take all, but we're going to just deal with the figure of the out-of-state tuition for UCLA, $42,994. Okay, now, in an athletic scholarship, you get all that plus the room, plus the board, the room on campus, you know, food and medical and all that. All right. That's going to be above the 42.9, but we're going to stick with the 42 right now. Now, I'm saying, see, because a lot of people are saying, well, then, you know, they work, you know, they get these scholarships and, you know, they're playing for free. No, they're not. The scholarship is saying, okay, look, we will take care of the tuition, the room, the board, the medical, and travel, okay, you know, during the season when they do these away games. The basketball department or football department or under the athletic department, they will pay those expenses. Now, in exchange, you've got to go to school. You have to pass, you know, you got to get that minimum 2.0 or whatever the minimum requirements are to stay eligible. Okay, you got to do the academics. Show up for practices, and, you know, you can't. I know of people that they missed the practice, they were kicked off the team, lost scholarship. So there's certain things that the athlete has to do, and if the athlete does A, then the college or university will do B. They'll underwrite those bills. Okay. That, now I went through the system. I thought it was an even exchange, and I know several people that went through that system, to football, basketball, cross country, track, heard no complaints. All right. Now, so they are compensated. The athlete is compensated by all of the tuition and everything we just named. Now, each scholarship has a cash value. Just on the tuition alone, as I just read, UCLA for out of state, because Jabbar, when he was Lou Alcindor, out of state, and we're quoting today's prices, the cash value of the tuition alone is $42,994. Now, let's say we switched over to the paycheck system, which a lot of entertainers and people like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar says that athletes should be, college athletes should be paid. Okay. Paid a paycheck. Because once again, he was compensated for his services while he was at UCLA. I was compensated for my services while I was at, I went to West Texas State University, which is now West Texas A&M University, up in the panhandle of Texas in Canyon, Texas. Now, so we were compensated. Jabbar was compensated. Now, if we switch that, and once again, each scholarship has a cash value. Now, if we went to the paycheck as Kareem Abdul-Jabbar versus Van Jones, because Van Jones likes the scholarship system, and Jabbar is talking about the paycheck system, and a lot of other people are talking about the paycheck system. Now, I'm looking at this several years later, because I've already been through the system, and I know a whole lot more, I mean, this life experiences. If you paid the athlete, let's say you gave the athlete, the college athlete, the student athlete, a choice. You want to be on the scholarship system, or do you want to be on the paycheck system? I still would choose the scholarship system, and just like I had it when I was in school, and here's why. When you're on the paycheck system, number one, your paycheck, and that 40, whatever the cash value of that scholarship is, number one, is going to be taxed. The local government, and he went to UCLA, so the city of Los Angeles, they're going to get their cut. The state of California, they're going to get their cut. The IRS on the federal level, they're going to get their cut. Of the whatever the cash value is, so let's just base it on the tuition of $49,992. You're not going to see the full cash value once you go to the paycheck system. Next expense is you got to have a place. You got to have a place to stay. Okay, under the scholarship system, you're living on campus. Everything is convenient. You don't even need a car. But if you go to the paycheck system, then you're going to be living off campus. And apartment rents in Los Angeles or many of your major cities is expensive. So, and depending on, because we're talking about 17, 18, 19-year-old kids that they don't know anything for the most part. They don't know anything about accounting. They don't know anything about business. They don't know how to organize a budget and stick with it, including some of their friends and relatives. So the tax man's going to, so not only is the tax man going to get them, but they don't, their life, they haven't lived enough to, you know, on average, there are exceptions, on, okay, how to live. Some might be sensible and get a room. Others might want to go get a three-bedroom place. So, and some of them will end up being broke, to be honest about it. Because, and the reason why I'm saying that is because they never handled any kind of money like that. Now, we're talking about, just on the tuition, $49,992. And the reason why I'm saying that, because you've got grown men over 21 that have gotten $50 million contracts, $100 million contracts in the NBA, some in the NFL, and within 5 years, they have declared bankruptcy. There's a documentary on Netflix called Broke. It runs it all down. All right, so next thing with the paycheck system, a 17, 18, 19-year-old average, your hormones are kicking in. A certain amount of those guys are going to spend money or misspend money on women. And just stuff that young adults do, you know. And then, if your parents put the touch on you, or close relatives put the touch on you, or friends, you're broke. And that's the same thing that happens to a lot of those guys that had a $50 million contract. I think like Latrell Sprewell, I think he had, how did he go through 25? I'm going to put it at, I thought it was $100 million, but he went through $25 million, and he's one among many. And none of these guys, and then a lot of these guys are depending upon, like even Jabbar. Jabbar had to, he had to play two more years right before he retired, he had to play two additional years because the agents that he used coming out of UCLA basically didn't manage his money right, and he went broke. So he had to play two additional years. Good, luckily he was in good health to go on. But that's the paycheck system. So, I like I said, looking back at it, I would, if I had the choice, and knowing what I know now, I would stick to the scholarship system, which is tax-free. I got all my needs covered, and my primary job is to go to class and be a part of the team. Simple. I don't have to worry about meeting the rent payment next month. I don't have to worry about where I'm going to get food. I don't have to worry about getting a job, you know, unless you want to get some, pick up some extra pocket money during the summer months, at least back when I was doing. I don't know what the rules are now on that. But in any event, we're going to organize a panel on that, on this topic as well. And if you guys have any topics that you want to cover, just contact us and we will get them on the air with it, and then as well as what else? Any guests that you might want to have on here as well. On that note, everyone have, well, let's see. Yep. Everyone have a good rest of the day. Oh, wait a minute. We're not going anywhere yet. Wait a minute. We're not going anywhere yet. Doggone it.
Of his life, he is calling out for his mama. And every mother heard him. We hear him.
We did hear
him. We heard
him.
George Floyd. We hear him.
Kadiatu Diallo was pained when she heard about the death of George Floyd.
As the mother of Amadou Diallo, having to suffer my loss on February 4, 1999, my wound was open again.
On a busy corner of the Bronx, a street sign signals a story from another time, one that shook New York to its core.
My son was a dreamer, and he always dreamt of going to the U.S. and getting a computer degree.
From Guinea on Africa's west coast, Kadiatu packed up her firstborn son, Amadou, and sent him to follow his dreams.
Amadou, at the age of 21, came to America, crossed the ocean, and he was doing everything right.
Renting a modest apartment, working where he could.
The last time we spoke was on January 31st, 1999. They said, Mom, I'm so happy. He said, I have finally saved enough money and I'm going to college.
And he was so proud of himself.
Absolutely.
4 days later, Kadiatu's phone rang again. It was a relative.
They said it was shooting, and then they say it was by the police. I dropped the phone.
Police said they were searching for a rape suspect and came upon Diallo. Thinking he was reaching for a gun, they opened fire. Four white officers.
Guys, anyone like to make a statement here?
5'6", 150-pound Amadou, 41 shots. It turns out he was unarmed. He was reaching for a wallet.
The problem was reaching for a gun is a perception. They saw this black man in the vestibule. He had no criminal record. He never even had a traffic ticket in New York City. Retelling this story today is breaking my heart.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Because Amadou was this young, generous person. When you see him, when you have chance to meet my child,
Mrs. Diallo, I'm so sorry. It's breaking all of our hearts hearing this story again.
All I wanted to do was to cross the ocean and come to New York City to let the world know who my son was. I was calling him name because I'm coming, but yet he's not there. So I entered the vestibule and I saw all these bullet holes
19 of those bullets hit Amadou.
And I went into his apartment. I picked up his clothes, and I just brought it to my face to smell him. My child was no longer there.
All four police officers were charged with second-degree murder. But a year later, a jury found them not guilty. Police have not been held accountable for many deaths that people believe.
Time and time again.
Now, as many grieve George Floyd and demand justice, Kadiatu wonders, 21 years after Amadou was gunned down, is this really a transformative moment?
I really pray and hope that is the case because we are tired. We are exhausted. Girl, I went to so many funerals.
It has grown into Kadiatu's lifelong mission, a plea for her son Amadou, rooted in his dreams of America.
From my heart to the law enforcement community, I want them to really learn how to see our children. That they look at them and see them as beautiful children.
How about seeing them as human beings?
See them as human beings. Let them live.